think there's Talmud Torah, but there's also the role and the way in which Rabbi Soloveitchik viewed halacha. Because Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't view halacha in the narrow, with a narrow vision of here are prescribed actions you should do, but when Rabbi Soloveitchik saw the word halacha, he meant the gamut of Jewish philosophy, of a Jewish worldview, a Weltanschauung, as he would say, to the approach to life. And therefore, it's, I think, important to discuss how exactly the Rav looked at halacha, and then we'll get to the Talmud Torah. I'm going to do it a little cursory, and I'll tell you why, because really, this could be an entire series, the Rav's approach to halacha, as in just his most prominent work is called Halachic Man, followed by Halachic Mind. So again, there's so much there that it's so rich. I want to just get a little opening into that worldview, because I think it's important to frame his approach to Talmud Torah and learning Torah by first seeing his approach to, again, we say halacha, and how halacha is so much broader than just, am I going to wash my hands this way or that way? Am I going to not do this malacha on Shabbos or not do that action on Shabbos? But rather, when the Rav said halacha, he saw everything. So what we're going to do now is as follows. We're going to open up with, we'd say, a shir, in the sense of looking at a topic and how Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't just say, here's a halachic question, how do I answer it? But we'll see the way in which he looked at the world was through these lenses of the halachic lens. Now, I'm being very ambiguous, and that's intentional. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote a work called Halachic Mind. Out of all his works, this is probably his most complex. It is tedious, it is difficult, but at the end of it, he says the following. I have the final paragraph after his entire work here on the source sheet, source number one. He says, to this end, there's only one single source from which a Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung could emerge, the objective order, the halacha. Rabbi Soloveitchik spends the majority of this book arguing that what is authentic Jewish philosophy? How do you know it's authentic? Because you sit down and you start pondering and you're Jewish and that makes it Jewish philosophy? No. Jewish philosophy has to be predicated on Jewish sources. What are those Jewish sources? And at this point, he critiques Maimonides. He critiques a lot of the Rishonim. Interestingly, Rav Hirsch, who lived a couple years before the Rav, also had a similar critique. And he says, the way in which you're going to know what the Torah wants from us and our entire orientation to life has to stem from the primary source that is the Torah and its manifestation within the halacha. Meaning to say that through looking at the halacha, we can mine values and hierarchies and almost and worldviews to which we can live our lives. So for the Rav, it was much less, and I think he writes in one place, it's not about the pots and the pans in the kitchen, but he removes the pots and pans from kashrus, and from behind it, you see there's an entire world of Jewish thought. Now, he was heavily critiqued for this. Part of the critique was, if you look Maimonides, he kind of viewed there was the Talmud, which is the dry legalism, if you will, and then there's the Agada, which is the Midrash, it's the more philosophical stuff. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, it's unified. And I think it's also important to note, this is his grandson, Rabbi Meir Twersky, who's a Rosh Hashiva in YU, he points out, that this is important as well, he distinguished between halachic symbolism and actual halachic philosophy. And I'll tell you what I mean as follows. Said Rabbi Twersky, sometimes we will give, let's say, a drasha. The example he gives, a very nice example, is we'll say, why is it we eat maror? Why do we eat maror during the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim? Moreover, when do we eat the maror? Not during Magid when we're talking about how we were slaves, talking about how we were oppressed. We eat the maror when? Only after we start singing Hallel, we sit down, we drink two cups of wine, and then we eat maror? Like, it seems a little incongruous, out of place. So, Rabbi Twersky says, halachic symbolism says, you know what that must mean? The idea we're trying to convey is that even when things are going well, there's still a certain sense of bitterness. Or perhaps only when you have bitterness can you have the contrast to realize things are going well. A beautiful idea. But says Rabbi Twersky, that's not what Rabbi Soloveitchik means when he says a philosophy of halacha. That's a nice idea. It's inspiring. We should take it with us. We can nurture it. We can use it to get through a Pesach, because halachic philosophy comes from delving into the minutiae of halacha. Because he says, what is philosophy? Philosophy is trying to ask these broad questions. For instance, he says, what is time? Is time a human construct? Is time something that's actually imposed from without, not within the humans? Well, he says, if you delve into the halacha, you start recognizing this idea of Kedushas Hazman, that whether we're humans exist or don't, there's going to be Shabbos. That starts to tell us a little bit about answering the question of a halachic approach to time. that, and again, he really develops this, and I think we'll develop it more in future weeks. It's from within, going through the halacha and really delving into it, you start seeing that there's these concepts and values and ideals that are behind it, more than just a nice idea, but actually a worldview. And he also, one more thing I want to point out, I meant to say this earlier, was where Soloveitchik says the same way a scientist approaches the world, what does a scientist do? A scientist tries to formulate axioms and postulates by looking at the raw data of the world and trying to find some sort of unifying idea, trying to explain, again, natural phenomenon, right? That's what a scientist does. For the philosopher, you also need to look at the philosophical ideas, find unifying principles behind that. Well, where are we looking for that? That's the halacha. That's to what the earth, for instance, is to scientist, the halacha is to the halachicist. As again, trying to find unifying principles, trying to find a worldview. So what I want to do right now, well, let's finish halachic mind, and then I want to give you just a proof text of how the Rabbi Soloveitchik approached a halachic question, and from within that we see how he totally viewed the world different than you might think. Are you ready for this? First of all, he says as follows. This is again still in source number one. He says, this is the second paragraph. It would help us discriminate between the living and the dead in Jewish philosophy. For instance, is of halachic nature in the Guide and the Kuzari, and what merely an echo of Platonic Aristotelian philosophy? It's a heavy critique. He says when you halacha becomes your primary source, so you can start figuring out, well, what is an alien source versus what is true Torah source. For instance, this is the critique. He goes, the Rambam wrote Mor Nevuchim. He says the Rambam was clearly influenced by Platonic and Aristotelian philosophy. Well, says the Rabbi Soloveitchik, how do we know if it's true, or how do we know he's just responding to Aristotelian philosophy, and maybe that's where it's stemming from? It's a heavy critique, no? He's accusing the Rambam of being influenced by Aristotle. The purpose of such an analysis is not to eliminate non-Jewish elements. Far from it, for the blend of Jewish and Greek thought has over time been truly magnificent. However, by tracing the Jewish trends and comparing them to non-Jewish, we shall enrich our outlook and knowledge. Modern Jewish philosophy must be nurtured on the historical religious consciousness and has been projected into a fixed objective screen. And this is the line he ends off with, a tantalizing line. Out of the sources of halacha, a new world view awaits formulation. Now, Rabbi Twersky said it's a very frustrating line because apparently the Rav was going to write a part two to this where he's going to show examples. But this is just how he ends the book. So he leaves it to us to kind of mind his works and mind. And again, he was a very prolific speaker and writer as well. A lot of it's been published after he passed away to see what he means. So what we're going to do now is the following. There is a prayer we say once a year at Mincha. Tisha B'Av at Mincha, we say the following. Na'achem Hashem Elokeinu es av letzion ves av Yerushalayim. God console the mourners of Zion, the mourners of Yerushalayim. Ves'ira av le'achor v'zuya v'ashmama. The city that is mourning in ruins, despised and desolate, mourning because she's bereft of her children. She's bereft of her children, ruined of her dwellings, despised in the conscience of her former glory, desolate without inhabitants. She sits alone with her head covered like a barren woman who never gave birth, etc. Right? We say this. Well, the question emerged in 1967. First year it was around now. Tomorrow. Is the Yom Yerushalayim. That year, Shavuos, Yerushalayim was packed with hundreds of thousands of people. First time they can go to the Kotel. That year, Tisha B'Av, there was a very disconcerting feeling. On the one hand, we're mourning the temple, we're mourning the destruction of the temple, we're reading prayers that our ancestors had said for thousands of years when they can only dream and think of Yerushalayim. Yet you're sitting in Yerushalayim, and it's full of people. Throngs of people. In fact, I saw today on the news that said Yerushalayim is going to become the first city in Israel that has over 1 million inhabitants. So you're going to tell me, look around Yerushalayim, and what's the most ubiquitous scene on the Yerushalayim skyline?
The temple.
More than that. What's more common? The cranes. Cranes. Building high-risers. It's cranes, the symbol of our growth. 1 million inhabitants, cranes being built, a light rail going through Yerushalayim, Torah being learned, and you're going to say to me, she's bereft of her children, ruined of her dwellings, despised in the contrast to her former glory? Really? That's what you're going to tell me? That's what you're going to tell me? And there was a lot of thought that went into this. Rav Gorin, who was the chief rabbi, Rav Gorin wrote a new Nachem. He went based off other texts. He said, we can't say Nachim anymore. We can't say console Yerushalayim, which is sitting bereft of our children. And he went ahead and wrote a new one. Although, I'm not totally sure of the historical timeline. I believe that after the Yom Kippur War, he recanted a little bit and kind of recognized he may have jumped the gun a little bit. You know, there was the exuberance of 1967 was definitely tampered in 73. Others had disagreed. Chacham Avad Yosef wrote a Tshuva Dichav Adas, Chelik Aleph, I think Simon Mem Beis, if I remember correctly, or Nun Beis, where he says, look, we don't tamper with the prescription, we don't tamper with what our sages wrote. So even if you're feeling like we shouldn't say it, but ultimately this was written by holy people, we're not going to tamper with liturgy. Rabbi Soloveitchik, however, had a very different approach. Well, number one is, when it came to text and tradition, he was a conservative, as in with a small c. He didn't like playing around with texts. But this is what he says. If you look around Yerushalayim, what do you see? Millions of people. Hundreds of thousands of people. You go to the Kotel, the second day of Yom Tov, there you have the Birchas Kohanim. You've been there? Birchas Kohanim. It's an unbelievable scene. It's fantastic, right? What's the most consoling sight you see when you walk out of Yad Vashem? Intentional? You walk out of Yad Vashem and you see the mountains of Yerushalayim and you see houses being built. That's like it's supposed to be the symbolism of walking through. You're walking through the Valley of Death and then you see the rebirth of Yerushalayim. So how do you say Nachim? This is what Rav Soloveitchik said. In order to understand it, we can talk about symbolism, we can talk about nice ideas, but let's get halachic for a second. There's a Mishnah in Masechet Sukkah, of all places. Masechet Sukkah talks about
sukkahs.
Thank you, can't go wrong. That wasn't a trick question. It talks about sukkahs. In the third parak, it's called Lulav HaGazel, talks about the laws of shaking the lulav, and the Hadassah, and the Rabba, and the Esrog. Says the Mishnah as follows. On Barishona, in the world of Deoraisa, in the world of what the Torah mandates, Hayalulav Notel B'mikta Shiva, they would shake the lulav 7 days in the temple. Uv Medina, and in the provinces, in the rest of the lands, Yom Echad, just one day. Lakach Mehem B'yom Arishon, the Pasuk says, take for yourself on the first day. So, on the level of Deoraisa, according to the Torah, we only need to shake the lulav day one of Yom Tov. Day two, no need. Day three, no need. The only place where the Torah says you shake all 7 days is in the Mikdash, with Nei Hashem, in front of God. Other than that, one day. That was the halacha. So in the temple, you shake 7 days. In Yerushalayim, in the rest of the country, you shake one day. Okay. Mishachar of Beis HaMikdash, once the temple was destroyed, Hizkin of Yochanan ben Zakkai, it's of Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great rabbi, who came after the temple, who was the bridge, bridging life with the temple to a dramatically altered life following the temple. One of the things he did a number of things. One of the things he did, by the way, was he said, Tein liyavne v'chachmeha, when he was living in the besieged Yerushalayim, and he feigned an illness, then feigned a death. They put him in a casket, they brought him outside, and Vespasian, the great Roman emperor, at that point he was the governor, meets him. And before he can attack him, basically, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, he greeted him as the ruler. So Vespasian says, I'm going to cut your head off. How can you? You're being Mordor Malchus. You're being disrespectful to the real ruler. I'm just a general, and you called me the ruler? Because you're the ruler, and at that minute, someone came by and said, Vespasian, the emperor's dead, and you've taken over. And the story goes on, and he did another act, and then Vespasian says to him, I want to grant you three requests, like the genie. So what are the three requests? One was Tein li yavne v'chachmeh. He says, give me yavne and its sages, as if meaning the sages, the rabbinic court had been on the run, they ended up in yavne, and he says, you might destroy Yerushalayim, leave them be. Which is an amazing idea if you think about it. Your Yerushalayim, the Semikdash, is going to be destroyed. You can get any request in the world. Instead of saying, save the temple, he said, save the sages. And by doing so, he preserved the Masorah. By doing so, he allowed the Masorah, the tradition, to go on because the rabbis were alive. Which tells you many, many things, but included among them is the importance of the rabbis and also the role of the rabbis when it comes in conflict with the temple. I went to yeshiva called Keren B'Yavne, which was in Yavne. So, Tein li yavne v'chachmeh, that was the motto. But the idea, again, is that ultimately what preserves our people? It's not a building. It's the chachmeh. It's the sages. The Masorah. It's Torah. It's Talmud Torah. It's learning Torah, which we'll see in a minute. Fine. Among the different, so Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, again, as we mentioned, he's living in this period where he has to bridge practice from the temple to a radically new reality post-temple. For instance, when the temple's around, as we've discussed previously, everyone prayed, but you also brought sacrifices. You live in a world devoid of sacrifices, so what's your relationship and connection to God? There had to be a whole new revolution in terms of prayer and what the role of prayer, the centrality that prayer is going to play in your life when you no longer have sacrifices. One of the things Rav Yochanan does, it says, is Hiskin Rav Yochanan Zakkai gets up and says, although when the temple's around, and you lived in Yavne, you lived in Yericho, you lived in Tel Aviv, you lived in Bnei Brak, you lived in Netanya, you only shook the lulav the first day, but if you're in the temple, you shook it 7 days, lulav notu b'nei yeshiva, from now on, we're going to shake the lulav throughout the diaspora, throughout Israel, all 7 days, zecher lemikdash, in commemoration to the mikdash. Why that is, I'm not going to get, I don't want to get into the details for that, but basically he said the reason we shake lulav nowadays is in commemoration of the mikdash. So we don't forget the mikdash, we don't forget this rule, or maybe there's an element of mourning here, that it reminds us we shouldn't be doing this, oh, because things aren't ideal. Whatever the reason is, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, although ideally you shake one day in Medina, what's Medina? Country, and basically mikdash one, seven days, now we do all seven. Problem, says Rashi, is as follows. How do you define Medina? I'll tell you why. Think about it as concentric circles. Temples over here, Temple Mount, Yerushalayim, Israel, the world. Okay. Medina implies the country, so I can assume that's Israel, and everywhere emanating outwards is Medina. Is country is outside of Israel, provinces. What about Yerushalayim? Is Yerushalayim part of the temple, or is it part of the Medina? The rest of the country. Fair question. It's a halachic question. I don't know if it's a logical question necessarily. I think it's a clarifying question. Clarify the role of Yerushalayim, as Rabbi Salvechik points out, because Yerushalayim is almost it's a funny place where, for instance, certain sacrifices like the Karb Pesach, you couldn't eat outside Yerushalayim. You can eat it, or you're supposed to eat in Yerushalayim, implying it has some sort of sanctity from temple. On the other hand, it's not the temple. So look what Rashi says. Ba Medina, the outskirts, the Medina, says Rashi, says in the next source, Ba Yerushalayim Sha'afu B'Gvulim. When he says Medina, he means Yerushalayim. And, meaning Yerushalayim and emanating anywhere outwards. That is to say, the Torah says, L'kachna behem b'yom ha'rishon, take for yourself a lulav over the first day, that's everywhere. Then it says, Shivas Yom, 7 days, you take l'fnei Hashem, in the temple, that means the temple. Yerushalayim, that's not the temple. That's not Temple Mount. That's considered Medina. And therefore, if you are in Yerushalayim on day 3 of Yom Tov, before the Takana, no need to shake the lulav. You're not supposed to shake the lulav. Okay. Then, we have as follows. Again, we're trying to answer a question of, should we say Nachim nowadays? Says the Rambam. Rambam, as we know, Maimonides, the Rambam was Rabbi Soloveitchik's best friend. Hands down. Best friend. He describes, and we'll see in a minute, him as being literally his best friend. Says the Rambam wrote his magnum opus is called the Yad HaChazaka. It's a 14-volume work of halacha. But he also wrote a running commentary on the Mishnayos, explaining the Mishnayos. And he says, Barishon ha'iluv not mikdash shiva. The Mishnah says, initially, we shook the lulav 7 days in the mikdash, 1 day in the Medina. Medina hu kol... Kohayaros says the Rambam, what's Medina? All of the cities. Shebe Eretz Yisrael in Israel, and for that matter and beyond. Milvad, with the exception of Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. So we have a machlokas, a debate between Rambam and Rashi. Rashi says Yerushalayim is like the rest of the country. And the Rambam says, no, Yerushalayim in and of itself is like Temple Mount.
Are they talking about specifically the old city or the city of the specifically
old city within the walls. Yeah, well, I don't want to get into that. There's a more discussion. Well, let's put it at the old city of Jerusalem. Ir David is probably what it is. Okay. So if I asked you, what do we have here? It sounds like a clarifying question. We just need a definition here. We need a definition. What's Yerushalayim? Rashi says this. Rambam says this. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's actually it's more than that. And this is where we'll see how he had this halachic lenses. And he also, by the way, is exposed to the way he thought about things. He says as follows. What gives Jerusalem special sanctity. What gives it special sanctity? He says Temple Mount. Temple Mount. That we look at it as a continuation of Temple Mount, as it derives its sanctity from Temple Mount. That's what gives it sanctity. Not the fact that it's rebuilt, not the fact that people live there. Yerushalayim, the rest of the earth, so what gives Israel sanctity? So the Rambam tells us, after we conquer it, the fact that we develop the land, we live there. In a sense, what the Rambam's telling us is, the fact that we are living and developing Israel, that imbues it with a sense of a level of sanctity that which will never go away. It gives it Kedusha. What gives Yerushalayim sanctity above the rest of Israel? Not that we're living there. Not that we have on every single... You look at the skyline, you see 1,000 skyscrapers, 1,000 major cranes. Not the fact that there are 1 million Jews there. What gives Yerushalayim sanctity is the fact that Temple Mount is located there, and emanating out of Temple Mount in concentric circles, if you will, is multiple varying levels of sanctity. And therefore, on Temple Mount, you bring sacrifices. We also then say, the next level over, you can even eat the sacrifices. And Rabbi Salvechik goes through a number of different instances where we see, for instance, the shofar we don't blow on Shabbos, right? The shofar we don't blow on Shabbos. In Yerushalayim, they would blow on Shabbos, the same way they blew in the temple on Shabbos. Why is that? Again, for Rabbi Salvechik, Yerushalayim derives its sanctity from Temple Mount. Now let's put this all together. The question that everyone was asking in 1967 was, how can you say you... Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, is sitting desolate and empty, as we say in the prayer of Nachem, like a woman without her children, when Yerushalayim is hustling and bustling. There's a light rail that runs through Yerushalayim. There's a million people living there. It's just you can't say, Nachem, God, comfort Jerusalem. So says the Rebbe Soloveitchik, yeah, if you look at it from the perspective of just looking around, it looks hustling and bustling. But what are we consoling Yerushalayim about? It's halachic status. And halachically, without a temple, it's devoid of its extra level of sanctity. And therefore, yes, maybe it looks like it has people there, but halachically, it doesn't have the same sanctity. It's like a maiden without her children. What Rabbi Salvechik did, what I'm trying to highlight is, he said, you have to go to halacha. And from within the halacha, again, this is not halacha necessarily about tying this shoe before that shoe, not doing this malacha on Shabbos or that action on Shabbos. What he's doing is saying, from within the, learning the sugya, looking, probing the depths of why the Rambam says this and Rashi said that, we now have a whole new way of looking at Yerushalayim. More than that, for the Rav, and this I think is the most important part, the Rav said, don't look at the world through the lens of our eyes. Put on what I'd say halachic glasses. That when Rabbi Salvechik, when he would look, he once said, when halachic man sees a stream, right away his mind jumps, well, is this stream going to qualify as a mikvah? When he said, when I saw this, he said one time he was a little boy, he was with his grandfather, and they walked outside, it must have been some break between mincha and ne'ilah. I guess the rabbi didn't speak. And the sun was going down, and Rav Chaim Salvechik turned to little Yasher Ber. And he said to him, you think that's a regular sunset? Because the sun's going down like it does all 365 other days of the year? No, that's a sunset of atonement. Fundamentally different. As that sun goes down, it's going to bring atonement to the Jewish people. Where are these halachic lenses? See that, perceive the world through the halacha, and then you'll start seeing a whole new reality, as Rav Salvechik said it. Then from within that, out of the source of halacha, a new worldview awaits formulation. It's like a powerful idea. Any thoughts, questions, comments before we move on?
Is there any sort of residual kedusha from having?
Let's not. There probably is. That's the way I feel. So what? Next week we're not going to meet because it's Erev Shavuos, but maybe after that we'll go through this idea and how it plays out other places. I think it's very interesting to see how the Rav does it. Just in and of itself, beyond just from the methodological point, I think just to see the various places he does this, is I think fascinating. One other thing I want to make of this before we move on to the part two of this is, and it's something we touched upon I think 2 weeks ago, that sometimes there are different approaches to, I'd say, Musar, ethics, Hashkafa, Jewish philosophy within Judaism. Some people say, look, I have the book of the Shulchan Aruch, that's one book. And I have the book of Musar, another book. And both are very important. Hashkafa, philosophies are important, and halacha is very important. But the overlap is less important to me. I don't really see the overlap. Because at the end of the day, why am I eating matzah on Pesach? Because Torah says eat matzah. You're going to start telling me philosophical reasons? Great, I'll save that for the middle of Magid when I need to say Dvar Torah. That's one approach. In a way, I think many people live their life that way. They do halacha one way, there's in their ideals other ways. For the Rav, it was much more than that. For the Rav, so fundamental to halacha was the philosophy that emerges from it. That we're not going to bifurcate. We're not going to say, there's the philosophy of it, and there's the halacha of it. Not to say that if you don't agree with the philosophy, you're not going to do halacha. Ultimately, we eat matzah because God said so. But it's God said to do it so that it inculcates within us certain sensitivities, or certain ideas, or certain worldviews, or certain values. And I think it's so important that it's often lost in today's world. People think, oh, it's just the halacha, but like let's look for values elsewhere. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, you want to know what the Torah thinks about any of the host of issues in life? Look at the halacha, the way, and it's doing that, and it works both ways. Through keeping the halacha, it also reinforces these values within you. And then through learning these values, it also helps you have a certain passion and motivation for the halacha as well. And in fact, what you would say is, maybe the very practical halacha that the way we live our life, that's a manifestation of the philosophy that we believe in. Right? It's also something that we try to figure out. I believe in this, that's a manifestation. And it's a way of bringing all that to life and bring it to reality. That through, I'm just going to throw an example out here, though it might not be a good example. Through lighting Shabbos candles, I bring to life a reality of the ability to mikdash, sanctify time. So not just I'm lighting, but I'm bringing a reality to life. I'm bringing values to life, etc. So I think that's just an important note to make, and now we'll move on to part two. I'll come to you after. Part two is, again, I said because it's Erev Shavuos, to discuss Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. You had a question on this? Your question was
similar kind of.
So I don't want to get sidetracked. Rabbi Soloveitchik, and that's Talmud Torah. Shavuos is upon us, and therefore it's important to discuss Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach to Talmud Torah. The core value that animated Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's life was Talmud Torah. He may have been a man who had a PhD from the University of Berlin, who, when you open up his book, Halachic Man, do we have it here? I should have brought it. Within the first page, you encounter more philosophers and more philosophy than probably most of us have ever even seen the book covers in our life. I mean, he literally, I once tallied it. He's like 30-something people he's quoting. Everyone from Kant to everyone. He's quoting everyone. I heard his son say he spoke 7 languages, including he read Greek and he read Latin. And you read his works that he wrote in English, and we need a dictionary. This is like his 5th language. Despite all that, the thing that animated his life was Talmud Torah. The pure engagement with learning Torah. This is what it was. He spent the first 20 years of his life, for instance, were solely within what he would say, the Arba Amu Shalacha, the 4 cubits of Halacha. He grew up in a house. His grandfather is probably the most greatest representation of his generation of someone who's utterly opposed to secular education. He thought it had zero value, his grandfather. Zero value. And yes, he may have switched at some point, why that is, kind of his mother's influence. And I'll tell you, he even opens up his first written work, The Lonely Man of Faith. The quote he opens up with, sometimes authors will put a quote there and nothing to do with the book. The quote is I believe it's from Rashi that says that before Yosef sinned, or what prevented him from sinning was the Demus Duyuk No Shel Aviv. He saw his father's image hovering in the window pane. As if to say, I recognize I am breaking away with my family tradition, and it bothers me. I understand, I'm bothered by it. It's there. But ultimately, despite all that, despite the fact he didn't get the PhD, and he was totally, totally well-versed and comfortable within the world of the academia, in a way that all of us who that probably put us all to shame, who, it's the reality, that's what it is. But his core value was Talmud Torah. He never moved away from it. And a Talmud Torah that was as traditional as it could be. It wasn't modern. It wasn't using new methods. I heard recently there was a Rosh Hashiva in Lakewood. Someone sent a recording out where they asked, why did some people in Lakewood not learn Rabbi Soloveitchik? And he responded, because he used more academic Talmud study. The next day he goes, well, someone called him and said, it's not true. It wasn't true. It's we would say, classical, brisker methodology. Real and to the extent and in a beautiful, brilliant way. He had a creative mind when he was known. But I think that was part of the tragedy. People talk about it. You can read it. When he went to Berlin, as in to Western Europe to pursue his academia, the Torah world was in shock because he was the protege. He was Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was the leading Talmudicist of his generation. This was his grandson, and it's more than just his grandson. Everyone knew he was an absolute brilliant genius, and we lost him. We lost him. And Rabbi J.J. Schachter quotes this, actually. He said he met someone who wrote a diary who was there in Berlin the week Rabbi Soloveitchik arrived. He said, and everyone was standing there in shul going, look who's here. Look who's here. Look at Mech. Rabbi Soloveitchik is a young man who's 20-something years old, sitting by himself in the back of the shul, and everyone knew that was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's grandson. And he describes who he was. He said there's a very cute story in there, not really relevant for this, but whatever, of someone invited, this person's mother or wife invited Rabbi Soloveitchik for Pesach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said in a very nice way, I'd love to come, but I can only come if I see how you kosher your kitchen. Because he was well aware that the standards of halacha were not the same from where he came from. And Rabbi Soloveitchik shows up, and she starts doing things, and he said to her, like, you know, why do you do it this way? Or he asks some sort of question. She goes, this is what I learned from my mother. And he didn't say anything, he left. So she's wondering, did I offend him? Clearly, I never studied it in the Shulchan Aruch, he must think it's not kosher. And then, a few hours later, there's a knock on the door, and someone delivered flowers from him. So she realized, as if he's coming. And like that, that was also the idea of like the Mesorah of tradition meant a lot to him, even though, you know, it meant a lot to him. But either way, Rabbi Soloveitchik was someone, he spent 4 decades, the bulk of his career, teaching Talmud and Yeshiva University. Teaching in, actually, one of the first things he did when he got to Boston, we started a yeshiva called Yeshivas Heichel Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. It was it lasted for 1 year. It was supposed to be a post-grad, I guess, base medrash for the elite. It only lasted 1 year because then his father passed away and they called him to New York to teach it and take over his father's position. It happens to be that 1 year, some of the greatest personalities of last generation ended up there. One of them was Rav Nata Greenblatt, who ended up being a rabbi in Memphis. He passed away about a year ago. He was an absolutely brilliant Talmud Chacham, brilliant person who just used to wear like a tweed gray suit and a little gray hat and a little goatee. People didn't realize how great he was, to the extent that there were a bunch of guys from Lakewood. These were guys who learned in all like the really yeshivish Haredi places. And they're on vacation in the Smoky Mountains. And the Chabad rabbi said, there's a get that's being given tomorrow. Do you want to come see it? So they said, sure. So they show up and they see there's a guy with a little tweed suit and a gray hat and a briefcase and a goatee. And the guy sees, oh, you guys are from yeshiva? Let me tell you some Torah. He said he gave them this brilliant shir, to the extent that the guys are like, who is this? And they said to him, would you be interested? And he was in his 80s then. Would you be interested in starting a yeshiva? And he said, yes. And so for like 2 or 3 years, these guys all went to Memphis and he was Rosh Yeshiva for them. Now he had, at one point, apparently he gave over some novelty he had in Torah learning. He started to cry. He goes, I've never been able to say this over to anyone because I didn't have that position as Rosh Hashiva. But this is who he learned there. There was a Rav Michal Feinstein who went to become the son-in-law of the Briska Rav. So just Rabbi Soloveitchik's cousin. So he also learned there. And Rav Nata Greenblatt describes there was no time, there was no set time for chakras. It wasn't like 7:30 chakras every day, but rather he said what we would do is we would learn all night until we felt, we just fell asleep. And then when we all woke up, we daven chakras. He said it was a year of his life. It was total, he said it was crazy, totally ensconced within the world of Torah. I mean, a lot of times when people in yeshiva, I had a pretty crazy schedule when I was learning in KBY. But like, this is beyond that. 20 hours a day of learning. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik. That was his life. My grandfather told me one time in Shir, so Rabbi Soloveitchik explained to Tosfos, and Ravaron Lichtenstein, who was Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, who also was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, I can't underestimate that, but he had a PhD from Harvard. He, as traditional as he was more okay blending both worlds. So my grandfather said, he said to Rabbi Soloveitchik, oh, that reminds me of an idea from Spencer's Fairy Queen. To which point, the Rav looked at Rav Aaron and goes, we're not, something along the lines of, we're not mixing that into the Gemara. As in, I appreciate it, but that's its place is not here. For Rav Aaron, it's very different. When we open up Rav Aaron's essays, he's quoting, he'll quote the Rambam, and he'll quote Henry Moore, that's where his PhD was in. He'll quote whoever else, now it's blanking him. He'll quote all these people. But for Rav Soloveitchik, that wasn't who he was. Rav Aaron actually wrote an essay about his father-in-law, and he said his father-in-law was like his namesake, Yosef, in that he had many, many different colors. He loved many different things. However, ultimately, he was all one unified tapestry, one coat. And it unified around, it coalesced around the Torah. That was essential. That was who he was. And therefore, what I want to do, again, I'm just trying to say, I cannot overstate his connection to Talmud Torah. So what I'm going to do is, we did last week, I want to read from Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is collected from various different essays and speeches he's said over the years. Read about what he felt when he was learning Torah. You'll see why it was so meaningful and important to him. Number one, in 1975, I believe this was to an address to the RCA convention, the Biblical Council of America convention. He said as follows, I have been a Rosh Hashiva. This is found on page, if you want the exact page number. Let's turn to page number 2, line number, it's like 7. I have been a Rosh Hashiva, a teacher of Talmud, all of my life. At least the major part of my adult life. I have taught many, many people. In fact, he ordained over 2,000 rabbis. I don't know how many, but many people. And when I do teach, time comes to a stop for me. I don't look at the timepiece, the clock or my wristwatch. I just teach. It is very simple. I don't know. For me, teaching has a tremendous and a very strange impact upon me. Right now, when you think of Torah, you think of a very intellectually rigorous experience, but it's intellectual, right? Tell me if you see any intellect in a way, and I mean, obviously intellect, but if you see it's intellectual, this is a very emotional description of Talmud Torah. I simply feel when I do teach Torah, I feel the breath of eternity on my face. Even now when I am old, of course, certainly not young, teaching Torah, shiurim, teaching Torah relieves me of the fear of death and all the blues, depressive moments which elderly people go through. When I do teach, I feel rejuvenated, as if I were 25 or 30 years old. If not for the study and teaching of Torah, I would have lost my sanity in the year of my triple avelus. Right? We discussed this in the past, how he lost 3 people in 1 year. His father, his mother, his brother, and his wife. I was on the verge of mental collapse and breakdown. Also, just see how autobiographical he is. So, you know, he's very vulnerable about that. I did not. I emerged victorious, and it is due to one thing only. I would say my mad dedication to Torah. I'm not trying to brag or boast. I'm telling you the truth. I was hit that year and the following years. I felt somehow because of teaching Torah, I was not alone. That I had somebody, that somebody was invisible. But I felt his presence to confine. There was somebody on whose shoulder I could cry. And there was somebody from whom I could almost demand words of solace and comfort.
How old was he?
In 75. He was born in 1903. So he's 72 years old. He's not a young man. If you turn to the next page, there's a portion in Hebrew I want to read from, and I think it brings a lot of this together. This comes from Rabbi Menachem Ganek, who I saw just the other night. He's the CEO of the Orthodox Union, their kashrus. He is one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's most, prime students, Rabbi Ganek is one of them. So he wrote a book based off the lectures he heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik. And in the introduction, he talks about this idea that Talmud Torah, learning Torah, is more than just an intellectual pursuit. But in fact, he says, the same way we call tefillah, davening, avodah shebelev, the worship of the heart, Talmud Torah itself is a worship of the heart. Why? He says, because what's tefillah about? Tefillah is about encountering the Almighty. What's Talmud Torah about? It's also about encountering the Almighty. He says it becomes what he says is it becomes, as we say in Parshas Hazino, a shira, a song. Talmud Torah is a song. It remove the intellectual part of it, which is very much a part of it. But he says a way of encountering the Almighty. So writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, writes Rabbi Ganek, after going through this long essay in the introduction describing how Torah is like davening, and Torah is a shira, and Torah is another way of encountering the Almighty. He says, Dugma chaya lilmo Torah shekulo shira v'avoda. I have an example, a living example, that I witnessed of how someone could take Torah, this intellectual pursuit of going through, is Yerushalayim part of the Mikdash, is Yerushalayim part of Israel? Does that mean we shake the lulav, do we not shake the lulav? Right? Intellectual questions, and I saw how they turned it into a song. I saw they turned it into a way of encountering the Almighty. Chazinu Eitzel Rabbeinu HaGrid Soloveitchik. I was next to the grid. The grid is, again, oftentimes we'll take a name, make it acronyms, we'll call them that. For instance, Rashi. Rashi, as we know. What's Rashi? Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon. Right. The grid is Hagon Rav Yosef Dov. So they call him the grid. I was next to the grid Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Kasher b'shiras toroso. Hayimargosh b'ulul ha'isuk ha'omid lefnei ha'melech. He literally felt as if he was standing in front of the king when he was learning. And when Rabbi Soloveitchik was learning, it wasn't just him learning alone in a room, but he was learning, it was literally as if the Shechina, God's presence, was resting next to him. I'll tell you what I remember, says Rabbi Ganek. Ketzad, Pam Kishemosa Shira Hashemti Hayartzit Shir. Begin with Shvat. Every year on the third day of Shvat, it was the yard site of Rabbi Soloveitchik's father, of Moshe Soloveitchik, and he'd give a 4-hour lecture in Lamport Auditorium. First 2 hours are generally halachic. When I say halach again for the Rav, it really means much more than halach. It's the Iyun, it's going into the reasons behind the Gemara and the precepts, etc. And the second half was more hashkafa philosophy.
What language did he do this?
I think it started out in Yiddish. At a certain point, the Rabbi Soloveitchik switched over to English. The story goes, the true story was, there was a person in a shir who one day was there, next day wasn't there. Soloveitchik said, "Where are you?" And he said to him, basically, "I don't understand Yiddish. I'm an American boy." And Soloveitchik basically said, like, at this point, the American boys don't understand Yiddish, and he switched over to English. So the Artzit Shir would definitely initially give it in Yiddish. I assume the Artzit Shir as well went to English. They've all been written up. There's two volumes called Shirim L'Zichro Avi Umori, Shiurim, given in memory of my father, my teacher, as well as I think a lot of what Rabbi Ganak gives over in his book is also, you'll see a lot of parallels. So he was also in the room, he took his notes and turned it into Shiurim as well. Okay, so what's unique about this Yartzeit Shir? This is the year of, as we said, the triple Avelos, the year where Soloveitchik, I said a minute ago, he was crushing, he was depressed. He was sitting there feeling this extreme, extreme depression. And just we'll point out, as we said also, and that was 67. In 65, I believe, he had cancer. So he was, again, it wasn't easy. That was the year his brother and his wife passed away. He was under tremendous agony, tremendous pain, tremendous depression. But I saw this awesome thing. Says Rabbi Ganak, he was young then. Saw this awesome thing. When he was being burdened by this tremendous pain. One break after another, one just again, just this pain after another. So imagine this, he's a man here, he gets up, he's 67, so he's 65 years old. He kind of gets up there, he looks broken, he looks down, dejected. He shuffles up there. He opens his mouth to begin the shir, whatever the shir was that year. Takafu miyad, immediately, right away, hayinikar ketzah shiras haTorah kishis gagin apiv miles kol yeshuaso. He goes, we witnessed this transformation in front of us from being a broken man to being filled with the Torah. That the Torah like woke him up. It took him away from this pain. It took him away from the agony. V'or ha'shor ha'shchina sh'listalva b'taraso, and the light of the Shechina of God's presence, which envelops the Torah, enlightened him, enlightened his soul. It woke him up. It took him out of the misery of that year. And the way he gave over the Torah that year, it was full of joy. It was full of light, as if the Torah was being given at Har Sinai with all the thunder, the lightning. That through learning the Torah, it woke him up. He felt alive again. As David HaMelech says, what did David HaMelech famously say? Lule saras chashashua. Had I not had the Torah as my delight, as a vanity mi'oni, I would have been lost to my pain. Right? David HaMelech says this in Tehillim. See, we saw how Rav Soloveitchik would have been lost to his pain. But lule saras chashashua. He had the Torah as his delight. But then listen to what he says. And this is so powerful. V'amu Rabbeinu bezdumas zu. He goes, and then Rav Soloveitchik said the following. And, this is an exact quote. Kisha. You can imagine this. I'm going to say it in Yiddish. I don't speak Yiddish that well, but it's written here in Yiddish, and I'll translate. You can imagine Soloveitchik is sitting there, and he's giving the shir, and he starts shuckling back and forth, maybe he's singing a little, and ay, 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 ay. And he looks up at us, and he says the following. He says, I feel hayomargish ki'ilu man to have omen ba'achar, I feel as if someone behind me, right? We saw Soloveitchik said the same thing in 75. Someone's behind me. And he's whispering in my ear. Rav Yosher Ber, as in Rabbi Soloveitchik. Vos zoktu v'yugan dar kushya. Rav Yosher Ber, what do you think about this question? Sitting there, he says he feels as if the presence of the divine is whispering in his ear. What do you have to say about this, Rav Yosher Ber? What's your contribution going to be? What's your chiddush going to be? Here's a tremendous issue, what we found with the Rambam and Rashi and Lulav. What do you think, Rabbi Soloveitchik? You're not engaging this yourself sitting in a room with an open Gemara. You're sitting engaging with the Holy One. You're engaging with the Torah. What's your contribution going to be to the Mesorah, to their tradition? This is seared in my mind, this image of how the Torah can transform one. How, more than that, I'll add, how you or each one of us can also play a part in the Mesorah itself, in the tradition, that we have what to offer, that we have a chiddush we can say, that we have, the Torah is there, and by learning it and tapping into it, we can play a part, not just in the transmitting it to the next generation, but also creating a novelty, playing a role in it, trying to answer a question for whatever may come up there. I'll tell you, the greatest pleasures I've had have been when I had a chiddush in Torah. You could ask Emma, I bother her a lot. Like, I had a chiddush. She goes, whatever. But like, it's, and I'll tell you, I had a Rebbe, Rav David Kava, Yard Sitz next week. He was an older man when I knew him, and he used to get up to give a shiur like this, literally like this. And he'd get up there. He was older. He spoke very low. He opened up the thing to talk. And I usually fell asleep because he talked like this. And I have one image the first time I heard him speak. I fell asleep. I woke up a half hour later. And he's screaming, waving his glasses. I want to kill my anger! Screaming. It just like woke him up. It brought him to life. Because like this was his life. And this, the encounter with the learning, was able to wake him up to bring a certain simcha to his life. I just remember that. That's the image I have, very similar to Rabbi Ganach. But we're going to go on. And I can... Well, he woke me up. He insists on salvation, but it's also more than that. It's a way of encountering not just the Torah, but also the tradition. He says, if you turn to the next page, when I sit down to learn, the giants of the tradition are with me. Our relationship is personal. And he often talked about this, how it wasn't just, these are names. The Rambam sits to my right. Rabbeinu Tam to my left. Rashi sits at the head and explains. The Rambam decides the halacha and the Ravid objects. All of them are with me in this small room, sitting around the table. They look at me with fondness. Learning Torah is not just a didactic, formal, technical experience whose purpose is creation, exchange of ideas. This is, I think, the key line. It's not just didactic. It's not just formal. It's not just exchange of ideas. Learning Torah is the intense experience of uniting many generations together, the joining of a spirit to spirit and the connection of soul to soul. That, as I said, his best friend was the Rambam. He really felt it. That it's, I'm not just engaging in this technical experience, but I'm actually engaging with the Mesorah. I'm engaging with them. And I think, again, there's so much more, and maybe we'll come back to this. But what I'm highlighting for the Rabbi Salvechik, Talmud Torah was a religious experience, not just a religious accent. It was an experience in and of itself. But I want to show you maybe where it all comes from. This actually is a nice way to end. Mother's Day was this past week, so it ties it all together. Are you ready for this? This is awesome. When I saw this the first time, I was waiting for years to use this in a shir. Rav Salvechik wrote a work that's called Bikashta Misham, and There You Shall Seek. Halachic Man talks about the man of halacha, what the role of halacha plays. Halachic Mind talks more about the philosophy. Bikashta Misham is basically almost the emotional experience of feeling God's presence. This is what he writes, page 142. Pull up here. He's describing a scene from his childhood. He says as follows. Imagine this is in the, I don't remember what town he was from, I'm just blanking on it right now. He was from Koslovich, a town in Russia. And his father, again, as we pointed out, his father was the son of Chaim Soloveitchik. So this actually takes place, he says, in the home of his grandfather, Elijah Feinstein, of Elzer Pushner, who's his mother's father. And he says as follows, I remember myself as a child, a lonely, forlorn boy. Often you find people who are brilliant. You know, they don't have peers. I was afraid of the world. It seemed cold and alien. I felt as everyone was mocking me. But I had one friend. And he was, please don't laugh at me, Maimonides, the Rambam. How did I become friends with the Rambam? How did we meet? We simply met. And listen to this. The Rambam was a regular guest at our house. There were days when my father, my mentor, was living in the home of my grandfather, the great and pious Elijah Feinstein of Prussian. So this is take place in Prussian. Father sat and studied Torah day and night. And that's also his image. Yeah. His father was constantly learning. A rather small group of outstanding young Torah scholars gathered around him and imbibed his words thirstily. So again, picture the scene, a small house, and we'll see how small it was in a minute, in Europe, the great sage of Moshe Soloveitchik, a beautiful face, by the way, if you've seen it, big beard, sitting and learning all day, all night. Where Soloveitchik is waking up, seeing his father sitting and learning, he's going to sleep to the words of his father learning. And what would happen was, I guess a few times a week, the students would come, and they'd sit around the table, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, or Moshe Soloveitchik, the Gram, would give shir. Father's lectures were given in my grandfather's living room where my bed was placed. So he's sleeping in the living room. Why do you think a little boy is sleeping in the living room? Because he doesn't have room. So they're very, very poor. They have a small home. And he said, what would he do? This is again a young boy. I would sit up in bed and listen to my father talk. My father always spoke about the Rambam. This is how he would proceed. He would open a volume of the Talmud and read a passage. Then he would say, this is the interpretation of Rav Isaac and the other Tosfos. Now let us see how the Rambam interpreted that passage. Right? For the Briskers, the Rambam, as we said, it's always about the Rambam. How would the Rambam learn this Gemara? Father would always find that the Rambam had offered a different interpretation and had deviated from the simple way. Rambam often would do that. So my father would say, almost as a complaint against the Rambam, we don't understand our master's reasoning. Why would he explain it differently than the simple reading of the text? It is as if he was complaining to the Rambam directly, saying, Rabbeinu Moshe, why did you do this? Why are you making things so complicated? My father would then say that the criticism, the way the Rambam works, you open the Rambam, we say it's 14 volumes, the Ravid or Avram ben David, he comments on the side, Rambam, this makes no sense. Rambam, you forgot the source. So that's how he comments. And obviously, we'll see in a minute, my father would basically say, like, Rambam, why would you do this? Seeming to say the criticisms and objections of Ravid are actually correct. Meaning, they're correct. And then what would happen? And that's when chaos would ensue. The members of the group would jump up and each of them would suggest an idea. No, this is what the Rambam really meant, the Ravid is wrong. And what would my father do? He'd listen and rebut their ideas. And then repeat, our master's words are as hard to crack as iron. But he would not despair. So after the young students are trying to explain the Rambam must have meant this, he goes, no, don't you know, it can't be for this reason, it can't be for that reason. His father, he said, again, think of this man, I should have brought a picture in. He would rest his hand on his head on his fist and sink into a deep thought. The group was quiet and did not disturb his reflections. After a long time, a while, he would lift his head very slowly and begin. Rabbi Sai, let's see. And then he'd begin to talk. Sometimes he'd say a great deal, and other times only a little. I would strain my ears to listen to what he's saying. Little Rav Yosher Dov is sitting on the bed listening. Also amazing, he's following. I did not understand anything at all about the issue under discussion. But two impressions were formed in my young, innocent mind. Number one, the Rambam was surrounded by opponents, enemies who wanted to harm him. And number two, his only defender was my Abba, my father. If not for my father, who knew what would happen to the Rambam? I felt that the Rambam himself was present in the living room, listening to what my father was saying. The Rambam was sitting with me on my bed. What he looked like, I don't know exactly, but his countenance resembled my father's good and beautiful face. He had the same name as my father, Moshe. Father would speak, the students were their eyes fixed on him, would listen intently to what he was saying. Slowly, slowly, the tension ebbed. Father strode bravely and boldly. New arguments emerged. Halachic rules were formulated and defined with wondrous precision. A new light shone. The difficulties were resolved. The passage was explained. I wish we had time to go through just one explanation. You see just the beauty of this as it's actually formulated. A new light shone. The difficulties were resolved. The passage was explained. The Rambam emerged the winner. Father's face shone with joy. He had defended his friend, Rabbeinu Moshe, the son of Maimon. A smile of satisfaction appeared on the Rambam's lips. I too participated in the joy. I was happy and excited, and I would jump out of my bed and run to my mother's room to tell her the joyful news. Mama, Mama! The Rambam is right. He defeated the Ravid. Father came to his aid. How wonderful Father is. But occasionally, the Rambam's luck did not hold. His enemies attacked on all sides. The difficulties were as hard as iron. Father was unable to follow the logic of his position. He tried with all his might to defend him, but he was unsuccessful. Father would sink into musing and his head leaning on his fist. The students and I, even the Rambam himself, would tensely wait for Father's answer. But Father would pick up his head and say sadly, the answer will wait. We'll have to wait for the prophet Elijah. What Rambam said is extremely difficult. There is no expert who can explain this. The issue remains in need of clarification. The whole group, my father included, were sad to the point of tears. A silent agony expressed itself on each face. Tears came from my eyes, too. I would even see bright teardrops in the Rambam's eyes. Slowly, I would go to Mother and tell her with a broken heart, Mama, Father can't resolve the Rambam. What should we do? Don't be sad, Mama would answer. Father will find a solution for the Rambam. And if he doesn't find one, then maybe when you grow up, you'll resolve his words. The main thing is to learn Torah with joy and excitement. I think what we see from there is A, the power of a mother, what impact that probably had on him, to say, your father can't do it, you'll do it one day. but also for the Rabbi Soloveitchik, Talmud Torah, which was his main pursuit in life, was much more than a technical exchange of ideas. It was literally encountering the Mesorah, living with his best friend, the Rambam, and through that, experiencing ultimately the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, resting on him. So with that, I wish you a wonderful week, be a wonderful Shavuos, and we'll pick up here next time.